I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy today to welcome Dr. Daniel Lee, the Assistant Provost of Fuller's Center for Asian American Theology and Ministry. He has been a significant part of our faculty for the last several years, and he is an ordained Korean Presbyterian Church abroad pastor, and he brings that experience, and he also brings a very fine scholarly pedigree. He published one particular book that I want to draw attention to, which was published in 2017, that's called Double Particularity, Karl Barth, Contextuality and Asian American Theology. So, Daniel, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. I'm really delighted that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Tell us a little bit about your own formation, your own spiritual background, what ultimately led you to an academic future, and how all that is tied up with issues of contextuality and, in particular, of Asian American issues.
I grew up in the East Coast. I grew up in Virginia in the Korean American church. And growing up, I don't actually think, and this is actually very common to a lot of Asian Americans who grew up in the church, I don't think we thought about our identity directly as connected to the gospel. It's something that was peripheral. And it's something that I think I basically came to understand when I started doing campus ministry. I was doing Asian American campus ministry. And a lot of Asian American churches and campus ministries, they gather for that cultural or racial identity, but it's not directly addressed. It wasn't until I went to seminary, and actually I went to seminary because I wanted a good Reformed theological education. I thought what I needed was a pure education that helped me understand the gospel, not something that was corrupted from what I understood from cultural influences. And when I say cultural influences, I meant Asian American cultural influences, because I thought all that was just corrupting and bad. It wasn't until last year of my year at Princeton, because I went to Princeton because I wanted a very Reformed, pure education. It wasn't until the last year when I was looking through my education and realized that these people I was studying, Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Calvin Luther, these people were all struggling to address the questions of their context and their time. And what I was doing is studying their context and their time and doing theology for them. And I said, that makes no sense whatsoever. So I think given that, I said, I need to really address my own context and my own situation. And that was really a big conversion experience. And it was actually very difficult because I thought that, I mean, a lot of Asian Americans, I think, will agree with this in terms of thinking, well, why would I want to be in my little pond doing contextual work when I can just be a theologian and be in the big ocean?
Right.
And I think that's that kind of internalized racism and kind of dismissing and marginalizing ourselves.
As though pure actually meant to follow a Western, largely white tradition, as opposed to something that would have a contextualized, quote unquote, label to it.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why I don't think the word contextual is very helpful in terms of contextual theology. What we really should talk about is contextuality of all theologies and to kind of flesh that out a lot more explicitly. What does that really mean for all theology to be contextual? And another way of talking about it is that how do we kind of realize in what sense is everything contextual and fleshing that out more explicitly? I think everybody would acknowledge that now, say, oh, well, it's all contextual, but very few people really kind of make it explicit in terms of what that really means.
Well, I think just to be sure that everyone's understanding the distinction you're making, which I think is every bit as important as you're suggesting, which is the use of contextualized theology was really a way of saying, let's take the pure gospel and then, quote, contextualize it. And you're saying that's not really the model. The model is there is no non-contextualized theology. All theology is already contextualized. And now what we need to do is look at what's happening in all of that and how do we understand the nature of the theological enterprise that happens in contextualized ways whether we're conscious of it, deliberately purposeful about it, or whether we just think it's, as you were describing earlier, simply the pure gospel, which in absolute terms doesn't exist. It's a gospel that always has and is placed in contextuality. Is that a way of summarizing it, or would you want to put it differently?
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. And one of the things that I've tried to do in my work is to flesh out contextuality not as a socio-political reality or socio-political kind of imposition upon theology, is to look at the very nature of God and to say, does God care about contextuality? In what sense is this an aspect, an attribute, or the pure kind of characteristic of who God is and how God interacts with us? Generally, what I say is that if God doesn't care about it, then we shouldn't care about it either. But because generally, I think the idea in a lot of contextuality is the fact that it was socio-politically, we experience these things, therefore we should care about it in the work of theology. And I say that's backwards. If God doesn't care about it, and this is not the very nature of who God is, then ultimately, I think it becomes an ideological imposition upon theology. And that's very, very problematic.
So let's choose something that feels a bit like it still is current, but it was a much hotter debate maybe 25 years ago. Let's take nuclear disarmament. That is a contextualized fact. That is that we live in a nuclear world. We live in an era, both past and present, where nuclear reality shapes our lives, whether we're conscious of it or not. The Bible clearly doesn't talk about nuclear disarmament or living in a nuclear age. So that's a very contextualized fact, as it were. Does the God of the Bible care about nuclear reality?
See, this is where what I say is that it's not as though God gave us scriptures and died or went away. What does it mean to witness to a living God, to acknowledge the fact that God's alive? One of the examples or one of the biblical bases of contextuality that I talk about is that the call narratives are very, very particular. And of course, you know, my book, Double Particularity, is talking about this thing that we have a very particular God. It's not a universal idea, but that particular God interacts with particular people throughout history. And when you look at scripture, you have the divine encounter that Abraham has, and then that Moses has, that Esther has, Daniel has, and these call narratives, the encounter that they have is not generic. It's not like a one-size-fits-all thing. It's not like Moses said, well, you know, I just want to follow God and have my identity in God, so I'm all good. No, there's a particular call in that Egyptian empire that Moses has. And we kind of generally tend to think the fact that we have a generic God that actually interacts with everybody throughout history in a generic way. And that's just not true. That's not what biblical witness talks about. So what does it mean to kind of witness to and encounter that living God in our time as well?
Right. So come back then to make the connection between that and what I was just asking about in terms of nuclear issues.
Yeah, so I think in that sense, the question is to attend to God and saying, what does it really mean to listen to God and how would God care about this particular issue? Now, I think theologians have talked about the fact that how do we listen to God's voice regarding these issues and how do we have a criteria for faithfully listening to God, whether it be criteria of humanity that Karl Barth talks about, do the work that we do support humanity? And there are actually other theological kind of categories that theologians have talked about and saying, are we faithfully listening to who God is? And does it really line up with the very nature of who God is? So in one sense, I think biblically we talk about encountering God in specific contexts. I think another way of thinking about it from a Reformed tradition is thinking about difference between adiaphora as opposed to status confessionis, where we say there are situations where we say, look, this is a gospel issue. This is not just a peripheral issue because it's such a fundamental issue about humanity, about God's kingdom. It's about the nature of God. And if we miss this, then we're missing the gospel. You know, Galatians might be a place where Paul's talking about you have stepped outside the boundaries of what the gospel is and you're no longer within the kingdom, which is really weird because I always point out the fact that Paul's writing Galatians to Christians, but he's saying you've crossed the line. This is actually no longer the gospel. You're not reflecting and the very nature of who God is and what the gospel is about.
So coming back then to your narrative, you go to Princeton and you have this really quite significant breakthrough, which continues through your PhD studies as well. What's happening to you in your own understanding of what it means to be Asian American as these kinds of layers of assumptions that you might have brought to the exercise are peeled away or changed or redefined?
Well, I think the first thing is I realized that I can't de-Asianize myself. I think what I thought earlier on was, well, I have this remnants of Confucianism and Buddhism and shamanism within me. What I need to do is get rid of these things and become a pure gospel person. But what I realized is that that's literally impossible. It's like unraveling a sweater or onion or something. There's nothing left if I get rid of these things. I think what I realized is that if I get rid of these, it's not as though I would just become a white person. And that's kind of a nonsense way of thinking about it. So what does it mean for these things to be reconciled to God? And that's actually one of the ways that at the Asian American Center, we talk about these things. We say, you know, it's not as though we're talking about becoming more Asian or not Asian. It's how do we allow God's shalom to come and transform all of who we are? And that's really what we're talking about, not so much becoming more or less. Or I mean, it doesn't really matter how one thinks about Asian American identity or whatever identity. How do we allow all of who we are to be totally transformed and used for God's kingdom? And so I think this is where in my journey, I think coming to terms with who I am and saying that, well, this actually matters to God. And what I need to do is figure out a way where I can allow all of myself to come into God's presence.
And restating it, what matters to God by the time you get to that place is that your particular life matters to God, not your particular life per se as an Asian American, as though that's a separate category from simply being human. But your context involves a racial, social identity that in part is defined by being Asian American. Have I got that right? Or are you saying something slightly different than that?
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because I think what some people say, there's this idea that the fact that when we're united with Christ, we leave our human particularities behind. We say, well, look, I'm not a man. I'm not an Asian American. I am a child of God. And which is weird because it's not as though you can be human without these particularities. There is actually no such thing as generic humanity. But we talk as though it's like that. Part of the problem is that our creeds, which are very contextual in their own way, like Chalcedonian Creed, we talk about Jesus being fully divine and fully human, without actually affirming Jesus' Jewishness, it starts talking about theological anthropology and humanity in a generic way, as though such a thing can exist. And this is where, in my research, I've said, well, look, what does it mean to recover Jesus' Jewishness? And what does it mean to recover Israel as a whole? Because when we erase Israel and when we erase Jesus' Jewishness, then we can think of ourselves as human in that generic way as well, which is just not possible. There's no such thing as generic human beings. There's actually only particular human beings.
That's very, very helpful, I think, Daniel. Let's move in a more very focused and particular way, in the words you've been using, to then immediately come to, in a way, the crisis of Asian Americanness in relationship to COVID-19. Part of the premise of this particular interview is the fact that we are living at a time where COVID-19 is a global pandemic, and where in places in the United States and other places around the world, there's evidence of serious anti-Asian American racism that is showing up. Now, that's a moment then in which one person, I'll call them the perpetrator of that kind of racism, is responding to the particularity of another person's biological and racial background, and doing so in a point of great tension over why are we suffering this terrible COVID-19 problem? And it in part is getting blamed on Asians or Asian Americans who are thought to be the propagators or originators of the problem. So take what you just gave us in the first part of this interview that is more theoretical in a certain sense, but now show us how it actually plays out in the crisis of this particular time.
I think within the church, what we've done is we've sought to look at each other in a colorblind way, as though a race, because it's a social construct, it doesn't really matter. And we tend to think of ourselves and saying, well, we're all human. The only problem with that way of addressing each other is the fact that we erase all the history and difference as well. When we erase history and difference, we can't see the problem. We can't see the fact that our experiences are fraught within history, are fraught within a sociological, a political context, and we just don't see what's really happening. And what I'm trying to say with history is the fact that there has been such a long history of anti-Asian racism in the West in general and in the U.S. as well. And one of the largest lynchings in the U.S. happened against Asian Americans. It's the Great Chinese Massacre of 1871 that left 70 people dead. But it's one of the things where we say, in terms of even mass lynchings, we don't really acknowledge the fact that this actually happened to Native Americans and Chinese Americans and others. We just don't really perceive these things. And along with the erasure of history, we can't really see each other. We can't see our neighbors properly as well. So that's basically, I think, what's happening when we erase this particularity and kind of have a generic way of thinking about it, kind of an abstract way of thinking about each other, our neighbors, about ourselves as well.
So let's imagine an Asian person who's experiencing that sort of persecution. And if we could imagine for a moment that there was an opportunity for that person who might be being attacked, there's been physical violence, lots of verbal violence that's been perpetrated against Asians and Asian Americans in the last month or 6 weeks. So in that context, let's say an outlandish thing is said or done. And now let's imagine that that person had a chance to sit down with the perpetrator. And let's further imagine, this is a lot of imagination, that both people were willing to try to have a genuine conversation. Now, if you were able to orchestrate that conversation, what do you think, and I realize, of course, this is going to be, again, a particular kind of moment, but if you can play along with me for a moment, what is the most important thing for the Asian American person to convey, and what would you most, in any case, want the perpetrator to understand?
Well, I think one of the things that we want to be careful about is trying to bring about, and I don't think you're implying this, but trying to bring out some kind of reconciliation as though they can kind of, because obviously that kind of reconciliation can be very problematic.
Yes.
As though, you know, they're on equal playing ground and we're trying to understand each other. So not given that that's not what we're trying to do, one of the things that we always repeat regarding Asian Americans is the fact that we have this idea of perpetual foreigner, that Asian Americans are somehow not part of America, is what haunts Asian Americans, right? So we have 150 years of Asian American history, but this perpetual foreigner stereotype is the fact that everybody's an immigrant. We can talk about, well, why do we care about immigrant generations for Asian Americans when in fact, you know, Trump is third generation German immigrant on his father's side and second generation, I think, Irish immigrant or Scottish immigrant on his mother's side. So I think there's this idea of a perpetual foreigner and the fact that Asian Americans become continually an other. So that's something that I think people have to understand. And of course, this perpetrator has to understand, why are you putting this on me when I've never been to China? When in fact, you know, there might be Hmong, like they have no connection to China, or Vietnamese American, like there's no connection, but it's this definition of racism, right? The fact that we're lumping together people of similar phenotypes and you're othering them and blaming them for something they have absolutely no connections to. So I think that's one of the first things, that this problem kind of resides in problems of how we see each other in this racialized lumped.
Right.
I think a second thing is that we don't really register in our society anti-racism as real racism. Mm-hmm. We think, well, is this really that bad? And this is where, once again, without history, it just becomes incomprehensible. And this is actually common, I think, even for a lot of Black and brown folks as well, and saying, well, is anti-Asian racism real racism? You know, aren't you all modern minorities? Aren't you all rich and, you know, well-educated? And this is where, if we erase history, then we look at only the last couple of decades, then we can say, well, maybe this is true. But I think people are misunderstanding how modern minority myth works, and the fact that it's a stereotype that's actually presented to everybody. There's a lot of poor, uneducated, or people that lack educational opportunities among Asian Americans, but that all gets erased. It's this idea of the fact that Asian Americans are rich and they are well-educated without realizing how the structures of racism impact the Asian Americans. And because this is all hidden, this is all erased, when terrible things are done to Asian Americans, it just doesn't register as something that's terrible.
One of the other things that it seems to me is at work in this is a human instinct to always find a target to blame. And right now in this pandemic, there's a desire to find a scapegoat. But I think another part of what ties to that is related to race and also different from race per se, is just the temperament of many people to be bullies, right? And some of what racism always does is it invites bullyism by those who are looking for an occasion to express that, right? And to find some opportunity of what they perceive as either justification for being a bully or even an invitation from their point of view, partly based on some kind of perception of power iniquities or some other kind of influence. I remember when I was at Berkeley in the 80s, and I remember being so aware of the fact that here I am in the most Asianized county in all of California. And there was overt verbal racism on almost every bathroom I ever went into at Cal, and on lots of fence posts and other poles where it was just clear that there was this incredible anger and resentment and jealousy and fury about somehow getting displaced by the influx of, quote, all of these Asians, unquote, who were taking the, quote, places, unquote, of people who might otherwise want to be there or who were getting lesser grades than they think they might have had they been in a less Asian classroom, right? So here you are in a context where supposedly you have the bright minds of the University of California, Berkeley, and yet the place was steeped in a kind of underbelly of anti-Asian racism that was really quite amazing to me. I had never seen it in such a pervasive way before. And yet you're in a highly Asian area. You're in this supposedly enlightened community. And yet here are the benchmarks of some of the worst parts of what it means to be human.
Yeah, you know, as I think about that, I think about John Douglas Hall talks about how our North American kind of inability to mourn. And when we can't mourn, one of the expressions of this kind of inability is to find a scapegoat. When we can't process or kind of make sense of our fears, I think they manifest as this irrational paranoia or racism or scapegoatism. Kind of like, who do we find to blame this thing? Because we have no idea how to process what's happening. And this is actually what's happening, I think, with COVID-19, where we have a lot of unprocessed and repressed anger and fear. I mean, I think the anger is really fundamentally fear. And because we have no idea what to do with it, we try to figure out how do we blame this on somebody else because it's just terrifying. And I can understand the terror. I mean, I'm terrified myself to some degree. But it's the fact that when we can't own it, then it's going to basically sublimate or manifest in some other way.
Right. Well, and it manifests its way inside churches as well. So it's not just culture externally, but really what happens inside the body of Christ where there can be anti-Asian racism as well. Do you want to comment on whether you think there's any differences between those two things, or are they just basically the same thing manifested in two different contexts?
I think the church often kind of aggravates the situation, actually. So let's talk about history and talking about erasing our particularities. I think in our society, obviously, there's erasure of histories and identities of people who are marginalized. What we often tend to do in churches is to talk about God's love being colorblind and race doesn't really matter. So we can actually end up erasing our problems as well. I think within Fuller, there are other people who say, well, why should we talk about race? Race is demonic, so we should no longer talk about it. The only problem is it's along with erasing the problem, we erase all the history. And of course, it's totally embedded in our society. It's embedded in our structures. So if we don't talk about it, then we will just suffer the consequences without really having any idea of what the issue is. One of the things that I try to teach in my Asian American identity and ministry class is that if we don't have names for what we're dealing with, we have no power over it. And as you know, biblically, there's actually great power in naming. And I find it really interesting the fact that Jesus often names a demon before he casts it out, because the naming in scripture gives you authority and power over whatever you're naming. And the ability to accurately name the situation is really missing in a lot of our churches because we don't want to talk about race. We know it has a terrible history, so we want to not acknowledge it. And that actually aggravates the situation instead of making it better.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So if you were king of the universe and you could adjust something in this particular time that would address a root that you would most want to affect, taking history into account, taking all that you've said about the reality of everyone living in their contextuality and having their own particular frame, what do you think would positively affect the landscape of what you're seeing in this discussion, in this sort of racist practice?
I think one of the things would be for us to kind of own ourselves. I mean, that's more of a generic idea, obviously, but to own our own particular histories and differences and to realize the fact that, you know, whether it be even Irish immigrants or German immigrants or Italian immigrants, this has actually happened to us as well, right? This has happened to them. This is actually something that occurs in history throughout time. how do we kind of see ourselves and our narratives and the narratives of others? When I think about undocumented migrants and their plight as well, I think it's so easy for us to kind of otherize other people and not see the fact that we're part of this human fabric and what they've experienced in our family lineage, you know, it might have been experienced as well. So how do we really see that? Being able to kind of see that history and that particularity helps us to kind of actually see our neighbors, which is one of the things that I think I've always kind of pressed for. This whole idea of kind of seeing difference and particularities, reading up to really see people. It's really difficult to love anybody if we can't see them, like see right. The fact that they're actually real people and they're actually, in some sense, very different from us. It's the whole idea kind of I and thou. We want to try so hard to see them as somebody like us, when in fact, people are different, and that difference actually helps them to see the other and to love the other. But because we want to kind of have this homogenizing way of thinking about ourselves and others, well, we're all pretty much the same. But when a difference shows up, we are horrified by that and we want to somehow destroy it. So I think it's a fundamental mode of how we interact with our neighbors and even particularly ourselves. And of course, fundamentally it comes down to how does God see us? What does it mean, the fact that we have a God of Israel, Isaac and Jacob, and not just a universal principle? God is a God of particular people. And that actually means that we need to kind of see ourselves that way and our neighbors that way as well.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is really quite personal. And I want to come in a minute to the more systemic issues, but I think what you're landing on is first and foremost, the kind of responsibility to actually just engage in neighbor love, the thing that Jesus says is central to our response to being faithful disciples. And I'm just struck by how compassionate and capacious God's love and friendship toward us is, and that we're made to reflect that and we're redeemed for the sake of demonstrating that in the world. And when the body of Christ actually live that way, we become gospel manifestations. And when we don't do that, we are actually subverting the very gospel that we're trying to supposedly proclaim and affirm to others. We're showing evidence of what it's not. I mean, this is part of what was behind an effort that I took up a number of years ago to write a book called The Dangerous Act of Loving Your Neighbor. And I was just taken by the fact that it's a long process in growing out of all the ways that we keep from loving our neighbor and into the practices in which neighbor love at least increases in our capacity, our willingness. And it is exactly as you say. The subtitle of that book is Seeing Others Through the Eyes of Jesus, which is at least one phrase that tries to capture, I think, what you were just pointing to, namely, am I really willing to see other people as they really actually are? Or do I work hard to conform them to my expectations that they should fit my categories or my experience or my background or my racial frame, rather than actually honor and accept and understand and see them as the treasure that they are in their own particularity?
I generally talk about how with my students, the ministry would be so easy if it wasn't for people.
Yes, quite. Exactly.
I mean, loving people.
So it's seminary just, life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just incredibly difficult to love people. And I think you say, well, that's the most simple thing. Let's actually move on to more complicated theological ideas. And we say, well, this is the fundamental struggle. Along with just that idea, obviously, I mean, there are other things within our society that I think it would help. So my kids, they attend Temple City School District. And, you know, they're like, what, 80% Asian Americans. Teachers are Asian American. Students are Asian American. But their curriculum still doesn't really mention Asian Americans. And because this is basically just part of the curriculum of our American public education, well-educated Asian Americans don't know themselves, even if they grew up in Asian American states or counties or even schools. So this is actually what's happening. There's just such profound ignorance about Asian Americans, the fact that we are Americans of Asian descent. I think I was talking about Asian Americans and one of the students a couple of years ago said, what does that mean? We're having this kind of Asian American meeting. And one student, as a Caucasian student from the Midwest, said, are you talking about like missions to China? I don't understand what that word Asian American means. And I was like, well, I'm talking about Americans of Asian descent. And he just had such a puzzled look on his face. Like, what does that mean? And so because we have this profound lack in our educational system, that it turns out the fact that most Asian American students that come to Fuller, and actually I would say most Asian Americans that are educated in the U.S., unless they've gone out their way somehow to take an Asian American studies, they will literally know more about Black history and every other history than Asian American history. Mm. And this is actually quite different than I think a lot of our African American brothers and sisters, where there's been a great kind of, it's not perfect, but there's actually been a lot more educating, a transformative aspect of how Black history has become part of American history and American education system. But it's not true for Asian Americans. And that really hurts all of us. This is where trying to get a Asian American culture informant, like, oh, you say, well, I have an Asian American friend. Well, I would say most Asian Americans, well educated, right? College educated, graduate school educated, might not know anything about Asian American history. And that's the case that I come across on a regular basis. And this goes, I think, to a lot of Asian American Christian leaders as well. It's not like they've been educated in Asian American studies or Asian American history as well. I think talking about my background, it took me like 5 years to make some sense of what Asian American history was, because I didn't get any of the education. I got a theological education. So trying to make some sense of what that is and getting a grasp of Asian American studies have been a really important journey for me, and also a really difficult struggle.
What would be some of the challenges for you? What would be examples of that?
Yeah, like even trying to pick up Asian American history, because I didn't go through Asian American studies in college. I didn't have professors. Just trying to make some sense of what that is. And because Asian American studies is interdisciplinary, I think coming from a theological perspective, I just had to kind of piece this together. I've had great friends like Russell Jung and, you know, Justin Tay and other people who actually served as mentors along, because they had to make some sense of it themselves. So I think trying to make some sense of what that is, you know, when I teach Asian American identity and context, I've had to kind of figure out, how do I organize the material in a way that would actually make sense? Because Asian American studies has its own strengths and weaknesses. How do we kind of communicate what the significant aspects are so that we can make some sense of it? And how do we kind of connect it to theology? So that's been a difficult journey, because it's not like there's actually like a very clear canon in terms of Asian American studies. And that's very difficult as well.
So what you're really giving us a picture of is something that on the ground is very, very real and personal and social. That is, being a person of Asian descent, Asian American, or from wherever else it might be that a person was born and raised. But then there's also this amorphousness that is in the season of how this is even coming to consciousness in an ever greater way, which has often been the fruit of what scholarship adds, right? A serious, sustained reflection around a particular reality that hasn't been adequately understood. So part of what I am often struck by when I hear you speak about these things is just the unfolding nature of the whole enterprise of what it means to think about being Asian or being Asian American, and then landing in the particularity of this moment when people who may or may not even know that whole vast literature or history that you're referring to, but who experience the personal impact and literal, sometimes verbal or physical attack against them because of COVID-19. That makes it even harder to get your hands around, right? Because it's as though you're sticking your hands into something that you know really matters, but is actually very difficult for a lot of people to be able to even see or understand or recognize.
Yeah, and I think situations like COVID-19 or other crises is when Asian Americans go back and it becomes a flashpoint for looking back at history and trying to understand themselves and realize the fact that there's a big void in terms of their education and how they perceive the world. But because so many people who've kind of been educated in kind of a white normative education that we've gotten, it takes a while to kind of realize the fact that that narrative that they've got received from their education, and it might be great education, you know, it might be Ivy League education, realize the fact that there is actually a fundamental problem with that narrative. You have to kind of come to an awakening. So that's why a lot of Asian Americans talk about an Asian American awakening, when they realize, oh my gosh, I'm a person of color. You know, and I think this is the thing that I joke around about. I've had a lot of people who said, well, look, we're immigrants, we're children of immigrants, but we're going to become American, white American. I think from their perspective, some Asian Americans perceive it that way. And when the Asian American movement started 50 years ago, what they realized was that they weren't going to go from immigrants and children of immigrants. They're going to go into white America. They're going to go from children and immigrants to racialized minorities. And that's basically what people realized, and that's how the Asian American movement started 50 years ago. And so it's almost as though for more than relatively recent immigrants or people who haven't really gone to that experience and who have been sheltered through their education or because of their ethnic enclaves, they didn't really come to confront that reality. And things like COVID-19 kind of jolt them and wake them up and say, wait a minute, this particular narrative that I've been living is not true. This modern minority myth that people have been feeding me and I've kind of fed myself isn't really true.
Wow, that is just a very complicated, long project to sort all that out, which is to say simply the most obvious thing in the world. But it's profound to me, because when I think about people who have influenced my life, I quickly have a significant list of people who are Asian and Asian American who have had a huge impact on me as teachers, professors, people who were mentors in various settings that I've been in, friendships, conversation partners, people who were full of the grit of their own story, who were willing to share some of that story with me, and in doing so, changed my understanding of the world. And that includes my understanding of myself as well as of them. And I guess probably more than I even understood at the time, that all of that was happening in a way that was written against this larger backdrop of self-discovery, knowledge, understanding, social change, et cetera, which hasn't really been unpacked fully. So everybody is working hard to grasp it all at one time. I was just the beneficiary of people who all I knew was their lives and their thoughts and their experiences really mattered to me. And they were witnesses to something that I felt like I needed to give serious attention to. So the thought of, at the same time, them living in a context in which so much, for the reasons you've given, is still so challenging and still both clear and unclear and shared and unshared. I mean, all of this underscores why I think the role that you have at Fuller and in the light of other people, I think of someone like Raymond Chang at Wheaton and many other people who are leading these conversations about race and Asian identity and so forth, are doing work that is just really, really important, both in a personal way, but also in this larger social conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of other people, obviously, that are working on this thing. They've done good work with this whole Asian American Christian collaborative that Raymond Chang from Wheaton has actually started up and working with so many others. I think in this recent statement on the anti-Asian racism in the time of COVID-19, I mean, you know, there's an awakening in education that's happening among a lot of Asian American evangelicals. And it's a great thing because this idea of self-awareness as Asian Americans, who've internalized so much of modern minority myth and whatever society has told them, that work has to be done. And that's probably one of the most important works because we can talk about other people not treating us well, but if we absorb so much of other people's narrative about ourselves, it's very difficult to kind of even speak up or to realize what's happening. I think anti-Asian racism often is perceived as purely an individualistic thing, like it's an individual experience instead of a structural thing. And it really comes with this kind of racial historical awareness that must be there.
How would you describe this structural reality? Because as you say, it seems to be mapped mostly onto existential experience, but clearly history tells a very different story. It's been part of a broad pattern, not just an individual experience.
When we think about race problem in America, I think a lot of people can see it as a black and white problem. And fundamentally, I think historically, there was actually a lot of credence to that perception. But it's really a whiteness problem that's actually had the most significant impact upon the Black community. But broader, every community suffers this whiteness differently. And when Asians and Asian Americans have suffered whiteness, it just ends up being erased. Whether it be, why are there only 6% of Asian Americans in the U.S.? I mean, I was talking to somebody, this Asian American woman, and she said, well, why does it even matter talking about Asian American representation or Asian American racism? Because there's so little of us. And I said, do you know why there's actually less than 6% Asian Americans? Because America literally kept us out with the Chinese Exclusion Act. America said, we don't want Asian people. And so the history of this goes so deeply part of the U.S., especially, of course, in California. This is basically where a lot of it has been manifested. The particular histories of even trying to make some sense of what to do with Asian Americans in the between the black and white body, whenever war or whenever kind of sickness happens. You talk about World War II. We talk about Japanese Americans and the incarcerations of Japanese Americans. I mean, we're talking about Japanese Americans who've never been to Japan. They don't speak Japanese. They've actually never been there. And we put them in camps and saying, well, you can never be American. I think one of the quotes from LA Times at the time was, a child of a viper is still a viper. It doesn't matter who you are because fundamentally you are different. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about like what happened, and this is actually what led to a lot of Asian American activism during the Vietnam War, all the anti-Viet Cong propaganda that basically said, look, all of you look like enemies. And so this is part of the racial history and the mindset that U.S. has had for so long. And it just continues to become hidden. When I was learning about the history of Japanese-American concentration camps, I mean, Japanese-American activists had to make sure to work toward making sure that these things don't disappear altogether. Now, you think about that. These are U.S. concentration camps. They weren't death camps, obviously, like the Jewish death camps, but they were concentration camps, and FDR called them concentration camps. But, you know, what was going to happen was that these lands are going to be sold off. There, no trace of them would be left if these Japanese-American activists didn't fight to keep this history. And you think about that, you say, it's mind-boggling, the fact that it's a terrible situation, you know, historical event can actually be erased altogether. And of course, in the end, Ronald Reagan apologized for it, and there was a reparation that happened. But even then, a lot of Asian-Americans still can't make some sense of what that is. I was talking to some Korean-Americans and some other Asian-Americans, and some of them were like, well, Japan did terrible things. And I'm like, this is not talking about Japanese. We're talking about Americans of Japanese descent.
Right.
And so when they internalize some of those things, it's like, well, we know what Americans are. They're white or maybe black, but not Asian, because they're not really American. And this is what we mean, this fundamental structural problem of how we perceive America. Mm. And that ends up being white normative. And it's toxic. It's so toxic. Even if it was true, the fact that Communist Party in China had serious problems with how they handled the virus, how's the fact that we look at a random Asian-looking person and say, well, you can't be American because you look this way? That's what we're talking about. It's perception, it's white normative perception of what America is. And that's, I mean, I don't know how long you have to be in America, because we've always talked about the fact that 150 years of Asian-American history, it's not about time, it's not about migration. And this is where I think sometimes we misunderstand. We'll say, well, look, it's because they're recent. I'm like, well, actually it's not. It doesn't change over time, because it's a perception of how we perceive what America is. Mm.
Daniel, thank you so much for this conversation. I feel like you've given us a picture of the personal experiences that Asian Americans often have in the United States, and also Asians more broadly. You've given us a picture of some of the challenges on the broad scale of our national life, but also in terms of church life, and also, again, our personal experience. So I really appreciate it. I hope all the listeners that have been part of this have understood what an incredibly important topic this is, and how our sustained concentration and awareness of this needs to be something that really reflects the compassion and mercy and justice of God. So I'm just very thankful for your role at Fuller, and I'm thankful for this conversation.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. I think for Asian Americans, hopefully this crisis will stimulate them toward their self-awareness. And for non-Asian American friends out there, to ally with Asian Americans in this time of crisis and to support them and to raise awareness about this important issue that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.